Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 11th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. This week, we have stories on the evidence for newborn screenings, how reducing phosphorus emissions into lakes has impacted nitrogen accumulation, and the latest debate on the formation of the moon and how we might resolve the issue.
One thing that a lot of people wanted was a piece of Venus.
Plus, David Grimm is back with a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The prick of a heel, a spot of blood, and the DNA is sent to the lab for analysis. This year marks the 50th anniversary of mass newborn screening. Despite 50 years of progress, including tests for phenylketonuria and congenital hypothyroidism, physicians still don't have evidence that screening makes sense for most disorders. This dearth of evidence is contributing to the growing debate about the best and most cost-efficient screening practices. Bridget Wilkin discusses the good, the bad, and the controversial of newborn testing strategies.
The first disorders that were screened for were very easy to treat, and the benefit was absolutely obvious. Now, we can test a large number of disorders, amazingly, with a single test. 40 or 50 disorders could be tested for. But making sure there is more benefit than the possible harm is quite difficult. And while it would seem obvious that detecting a disorder early should be a benefit, that isn't always so, because they're very rare disorders and we don't always know enough about them. And it is amazing the lack of evidence there is about benefit. There's more evidence about harm. There are some screening disorders for which they are now regarded as benign. Some of these babies get put on long-term treatment, and that's really harmful. And then we are also finding screening will identify babies with abnormal test results but who remain well. And no one knows whether or not they might need treatment. So we're finding mild variants of a disorder, and that can be easy to manage or very difficult, and it's become rather difficult to manage recently.
And if screening for disorders increases, so too does the likelihood of false positives. So how are false positives complicating the discussion?
I think they do impact on several things. But I'll give you the example of a very rare, very awful disorder called Krabbe disease. Devastating, affects the nervous system, death generally in the first 2 years. And in the first 1 million babies tested, 228 recorded a positive result, so they would be called false positives, or most of them. Mm-hmm. Of that 228, 114 were confirmed to be sort of positive, with low or medium risk of being affected, low enzyme activity, positive DNA testing for some, but they all remain asymptomatic. So for this devastating disease, the parents say, yes, they might have it, but they put in a sort of limbo. Mm-hmm. In point of fact, new studies have shown that the public does tolerate a certain level of false positive results if they're well informed in advance. But it is a big problem, and it depends how averse you are to the possibility of missing a case by screening, or how averse you are to having a high false positive rate, and those are balances that you have to come to.
And there are many different newborn screening systems around the world, so let's take a closer look at two of them. How do the UK and the US differ in their approach to the same problem?
Well, they're very different. The UK is very cautious. The regulatory body has concentrated on avoiding the harms, for example, from false positive results, which cause anxiety and may cause unnecessary treatment. Mm-hmm. And the UK also wants to ensure that the money is well spent. That is to say that there's a defined benefit, which is often impossible to be sure before screening is undertaken as a trial. Now, the US has been much more daring. They've quickly embraced new technology, but it was initially done, for example, without putting in place a system for assessing the effect. So some new screening, this tandem mass spectrometry technology, started in the mid-90s without any good evidence of benefit. And the disorders to be screened for were largely written into state laws, but the process was a bit haphazard, so some disorders were included which we now think are benign. And, for example, cystic fibrosis only just scraped in as the very last lowest-ranked disorder to add. But there are ethical issues with both approaches. The U.S. screens for lots of disorders, and if there isn't careful consideration, which now there is, but that maximizes the harms. And the UK approach really minimizes the harms from screening, but it causes harm from not screening. They, using again this tandem mass spectrometry, the US screens for more than 30 rare disorders, while the UK screens for 2, and they're trialing 5 more. But one of these 5 is a rare and again awful disorder called glutaric aciduria. And it had already been shown clearly to be greatly benefited by early diagnosis. And whilst the UK has been gradually considering screening for this and a number of other disorders, for at least 8 years, about 8 or 10 UK children will have died or suffered irreparable neurological damage from that one disorder each year. So that's really a lot when the cost of adding that particular disorder to a screening panel is absolutely tiny.
Right.
Very tiny cost.
And also in your article, you mention how early onset versus late onset illnesses is sort of also complicating the discussion. Can you talk about that?
I think that is complicating the discussion. If we go back to my example of Krabbe disease, some of those still don't have any effect, may yet develop the disease, and that will be a late onset, and we don't know if any treatment would have made any difference or not. But more importantly, I think, is the possibility of doing general DNA testing. And I think if you do DNA testing, either some fairly targeted testing or even a sort of whole genome screening, then you've got the possibility of finding out a lot of things which are adult onset. Do we want to screen little newborn babies and say, oh, oops, you've got this mutation, and that means you might develop heart disease in your 50s. Well, that might be a good thing if you can do something about it. But in general, I think we need to firmly decide, are we trying to screen for adult onset things? Are we trying to screen for risks? We could screen for the risk of developing leukemia, but that risk will include, say, finding 10 people of whom only one may develop the disorder, and we don't know how to prevent that anyway.
Mm-hmm. And what other kinds of recommendations would you make to improve standards and practices?
Well, I think that follow-up and assessment of effects of screening needs to be actually part of the screening program. It needs to be built in to the screening program and properly funded. Then I think pilot programs should be explicitly as research so that it requires separate consent from parents. This has been tried in Massachusetts, for example, and it worked. It didn't lead to a lot of parents refusing to be part of it all. So in the US, they should rethink having screening written into law, because voluntary screening results in close to 100% coverage. But if you write it into law, that's very difficult, especially if you're running a pilot program and you might want to stop doing it. The other thing, again, this is specifically for the US, is you must deal very nicely with advocacy groups. Advocacy groups are very valuable, but at the same time, they shouldn't trump the science. It seems wrong to have an expert committee looking carefully at a disorder, deciding it doesn't merit screening at this time, and then having an advocacy group able to pressure states into writing it into their law. Mm-hmm. So I think we just need to talk about all of these things.
Well, Bridget Wilkin, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Bridget Wilkin scrutinizes newborn screening practices in a policy forum this week in Science.
Last month, Daniel Clary attended a conference on the origins of the moon. Still a hotly debated topic, Clary spoke with me about the strengths and weaknesses of the many current theories on this age-old problem.
Before scientists had access to moon rocks,
there were a number of theories that had gone around about how the moon could have formed. You know, these included that they formed at the same time from the same disk of dust and debris around the sun. Another one was that the moon was just another planetesimal wanderer drifting through the solar system and got caught in Earth's gravitational field. And there was another one that proto-Earth was spinning so fast that it, you know, threw out a blob of material while it was still molten, you know, just from centrifugal force. And that settled down to become the moon. But all of these scenarios all had problems that didn't quite fit with the Earth-Moon system that we have now in terms of, you know, how fast it's spinning and the age of the moon and the size of the moon didn't quite fit. So once scientists had access to moon rocks, then everything changed.
Mm-hmm. One theory that's held on for a very long time is this giant impactor theory. Why has that outlasted the others?
I think because it just seemed to work. It answered most of the problems that people had about the dynamics of the system. So in other words, the age of the moon, the size of the moon, the rate at which it's spinning, and also the rate at which it's orbiting the Earth. And if you had a particular size of impactor, you know, so this would have been a wandering planet from somewhere else in the solar system, about the size of Mars, about a tenth of the size of the Earth. If it hit the Earth at a relatively slow speed with a glancing blow, then people think it would have knocked off a lot of material that would have settled into a disk around the Earth and produced something pretty much like the moon we have now. And with the right amount of angular momentum, that's the key factor, because they didn't think there was a way you could lose angular momentum. So essentially, the rate at which the material was spinning then has to be, you know, the same amount of angular momentum as we have now.
Right.
So that was a key constraint on the theory.
But there are flaws in this giant impactor scenario. Which pieces don't fit?
Well, this came up quite early when people started looking at the moon rocks that the Apollo astronauts had brought back from their various visits to the moon. So one of the things that geochemists did was they looked at the ratio of isotopes of certain elements. Oxygen is a particular one which has three stable isotopes, oxygen 16, 17, 18. And the ratio of abundance of those three isotopes in a rock seemed to be a very clear marker of where in the solar system it came from, because they'd looked at meteorites that came from Mars, and they have very different ratios from rocks from Earth, and similarly from asteroids, again, very different. But when they looked at the moon rocks, they had almost exactly the same ratios as Earth rocks. And that wasn't such a surprise at first, because in the giant impact theory, people thought that everything would get mixed up. So even if the impactor came from somewhere else and had very different isotope ratios, if it was thoroughly mixed with all the Earth material that it knocked off the Earth, then the moon would look pretty similar to the Earth. But people started to doubt that theory a bit later when computers became sophisticated enough that they could do computer simulations of the impact. And these simulations showed very clearly that in such a collision, the moon would be made up mostly of material from the impactor, not an even mixture of impactor and Earth. So you would expect different isotope ratios from the Earth and moon.
And what about the idea that the impactor and the Earth were made of the same material, and so you wouldn't be able to tell whether they are mixed, or it was mostly Earth or mostly impactor?
Yeah, so that would produce what we see now, mm-hmm. this very similar isotope ratio between the Earth and the moon. But, you know, all the signs are that things from elsewhere in the solar system have different isotope ratios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some had argued that maybe the Earth and the impactor formed in the same part of the solar system, so they would be made of the same stuff. But one recent paper said that even if that were the case, because Earth is so large, it would have attracted material from over a wide area. You know, it would have attracted in other small planets and asteroids and things like that. So its makeup would be very different from something that was much smaller, like the impactor.
So if the materials making up these colliding objects are so different, is there a way to get a moon that's made mostly of Earth?
Yeah, well, that's what researchers are struggling with now, because they can't get away from this fact that they have these two bodies that look like they're made of the same stuff. So how did that come about? So one way that someone has proposed is that straight after the collision, there would be so much heat generated that the Earth would just become a molten ball of magma, and all the material spewed out would be in molten or vapor form. And if this cloud or disk of material that was knocked off the Earth lasted for a considerable period, they reckoned it would last about 100 to 1,000 years, you might have a lot of mixing. So all that material that was originally the impactor would just slowly over those 1,000 years get mixed with material from around the Earth and from on the Earth's surface. And so at the end of 1,000 years, the moon and the Earth would be indistinguishable. That's one idea. The other idea is that you could have a more violent impact. So either there were two that people discussed at the recent meeting in London, where you had a much smaller impactor that hit an Earth that was spinning much faster. And in that case, the moon would be formed from material from the Earth magma, and essentially the tiny impactor would just be subsumed into the Earth. It would all be thoroughly mixed together, and you would end up with Earth and Moon made of the same stuff. And another option is if the original Earth was slightly smaller and the impactor was larger, so they were quite close together in size, two things like that in a head-on collision, everything's going to get mixed together completely.
So let's hear the caveats. What's wrong with these theories?
Well, those two other collision scenarios, the problem with those is you end up with an Earth-Moon system that is spinning too fast. It's got too much angular momentum. One of the teams that put forward these scenarios suggested there was a way you could get rid of angular momentum. It's a sort of resonance where the moon's orbit gets sort of locked in a particular position as it orbits around the sun. And this has the effect of draining angular momentum from the Earth-Moon system and dumping it onto the sun. So it sort of speeds up the sun while it slows down the moon. But at the meeting, there was some doubt over whether that mechanism would work and would be able to extract enough angular momentum from the Earth-Moon system to get to the amount that we see today. So there's still a lot to do, and researchers are working hard on it.
None of the proposed models is complete at this point. What pieces are missing that we could go out and find? What kind of data could we collect to resolve this debate?
I think people want to do more studies of the moon rocks and the meteorites that all the isotope ratios are based on. You know, they've got them pretty well nailed down, but I think they think if they could get them a little bit better, they might be able to see differences between the Earth and the moon, or maybe some finessing of the ratios of other planetary bodies that would show them the way to go. Another thing they want to do is modeling these alternative scenarios more closely. You know, if there's lots of scenarios kicking around, if you can study them more closely and start to see flaws in one or two of them, they can be eliminated and you'll narrow the fields. But one thing that a lot of people wanted was a piece of Venus, because that would tell them a lot. This idea that the isotope ratios vary throughout the solar system is only really based on Mars. And Mars is quite a small sample of all the terrestrial planets. You know, most of the mass of the terrestrial planets is based in Earth and Venus. So if you could get a piece of Venus and see what its isotope ratios were, if they were very similar to Earth's, that paints a whole different picture on the isotope ratios across the solar system, because maybe they don't vary that much from place to place.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay. Thank you.
Daniel Clary is a deputy news editor for Science. He writes about making the moon in this week's issue.
Nothing turns away an eager swimmer like a lake filled with algae. The slimy, not to mention occasionally harmful goop that blooms in lakes and rivers around the world can often be attributed to nitrogen and phosphorus pollution. And while current strategies focus on reducing phosphorus input from human activity, Jacques Finlay tells Linda Poon that the approach may actually be doing more harm than good.
Many of our aquatic ecosystems are polluted, and one of the main sources of pollution is excess nutrients, primarily nitrogen and phosphorus, which come from a variety of human activities. Simply put, too much of these nutrients cause excessive algal growth, leading to water quality degradation. Much of the efforts to improve water quality focus on reducing phosphorus, and this is a success story, at least in part. We've cleaned up many, but by no means all, lakes through reducing phosphorus. However, when we reduce phosphorus, we also decrease microbial processes that remove nitrogen from water. If nitrogen inputs are not controlled, we see nitrogen accumulation in large lakes, which can lead to nitrogen pollution downstream in rivers and coastal areas. So by reducing one aquatic pollutant, phosphorus, we are in some cases worsening another problem.
So let's start at defining the roles of reactive nitrogen and phosphorus in the aquatic ecosystems.
Nitrogen and phosphorus are essential nutrients for aquatic life and often limit the growth of algae at the base of the food web. There's a lot of debate about where and when phosphorus versus nitrogen is limiting to algal growth, but what is clear is that they both are very important nutrients and are both increased by a variety of human actions. Bacteria can remove nitrogen added to lakes by humans through processes that convert nitrogen in the lake to atmospheric gases, and phosphorus strongly stimulates this process.
So as you mentioned, there is this excess of nitrogen and phosphorus in the lakes and rivers. So how's that affecting the ecosystems? And in turn, how does that nutrient pollution affect human health?
Excess nitrogen and phosphorus leads to eutrophication, which leads to a host of problems: loss of biodiversity, drinking water contamination, fish die-off, reduced recreational uses. Blooms of toxic algae can result from eutrophication, and these negatively influence human health.
And when we're talking about affecting human health, what kind of impacts are we talking about?
There are organisms, cyanobacteria, that produce a variety of toxins which are harmful to get on your skin, for example, or to ingest for both humans and pets, such as dogs, that might swim in water.
So where is all this excess nutrients coming from? Can you kind of talk about the different sources?
The sources are really diverse. The most important local source depends on where you live. Sewage, lawn fertilizer, vehicle exhaust, and pets dominate in highly developed areas, while farming represents the largest source in agricultural areas. And in more remote areas, atmospheric transport can be very important.
Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, one of the strategies is to decrease the source of phosphorus, but there have been some unintended consequences to this approach. So what's happening?
Reducing nutrient transfer from land to water is a really important management goal. Nutrients in the right place are highly beneficial, and as some of my colleagues here in Minnesota have pointed out, any losses of nutrients from land to water represent an economic loss as well as an ecological impairment. Our study shows that we need to pay attention to both phosphorus and nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Reductions in phosphorus without similarly effective nitrogen controls can lead to accumulation of nitrogen in large lakes. And when that nitrogen flows downstream to coastal zones, it'll have a negative influence there.
Mm-hmm. So let's kind of step back and talk about how you came to this conclusion. Can you briefly describe your method?
Yes. So we looked at lakes across all of the systems where we could get data, and that primarily means Europe and North America. For our methods, we used a comparative approach by examining the differences between the amount of nitrogen going into lakes and how much nitrogen is coming out in stream flow. We coupled these nitrogen budgets with time series analysis of nitrogen and phosphorus concentration in large lakes. And the work was motivated by thinking about the case of a single lake, Lake Superior. So Lake Superior is a lake that we'd expect to efficiently remove nitrogen, but it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It also has extremely low phosphorus concentrations. And there's some evidence that phosphorus levels have decreased, that productivity has decreased in the lake. So this work really arose from efforts to generalize from a single system.
Mm-hmm. How were you able to single out phosphorus as the factor? I mean, you looked at 12 different lakes and they're all different sizes. They each have different ecosystems.
That's a great question. And we used a variety of methods and we compared across many different types of lakes that have really different hydrology, different phosphorus concentration. And so by looking across this large data set, we were able to statistically pinpoint phosphorus as playing a role along with the other factors that affect nitrogen movement through lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we coupled that with an independent data set to test predictions from what we found in these large lakes through the long-term time series.
Mm-hmm. So, as she's mentioned, that doesn't mean we should just stop reducing phosphorus input. So, what kind of solutions are you recommending here?
Yeah, we need to continue to reduce phosphorus losses from landscapes. We need to retain that phosphorus on land where it's needed to maintain productivity. At the same time, we need to work harder to reduce nitrogen losses from the land, which is a little more difficult, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, systems that lack enough phosphorus to remove nitrogen will see more and more nitrogen accumulation and associated impacts. And things that we can do, things that people are doing all over the world are, you know, studying precision agriculture, wetland restoration, mm-hmm. controlled drainage from agricultural fields, and reductions in emissions from fossil fuel combustion. These are some of the ways that we can directly reduce nitrogen inputs to aquatic ecosystems.
Do we just have to pay attention to phosphorus and nitrogen? What about some of the other elements in the lake?
It's a great question. And we certainly need to pay attention to things like silica and iron, which are two elements that can be limiting under some conditions and that haven't received as much attention compared to nitrogen and phosphorus.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jacques Finlay, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Jacques Finlay and colleagues write about human influences on freshwater nitrogen accumulation in this week's issue.
This Week in Science. On the site this week, you can find a free editorial by Editor-in-Chief Marcia McNutt on the U.S. government shutdown, a research article on vilification, or how the gut gets its villi, and a report on the rocky remnants of a water-bearing world. In a News Focus story, Robert Service writes about the future of biology. Will wet labs become endangered? And in the commentary section, we have a perspective on mini-brains, the latest in organoids. You can check out all these stories and more at www.sciencemag.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, Science Now, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first up, we have a story on what happens when historians and geneticists team up. This is a story where genetics meets history. Let's start with the artifacts in play. We have a handkerchief supposedly bloodied by the decapitation of the last French king and a mummified severed head from a British king. What do these things have to do with each other?
Well, the French king was Louis the 16th. As you said, he was the last French king. He was beheaded in 1793 during the French Revolution. And actually, when he was beheaded, according to legend, a witness soaked up his blood with a handkerchief and stored it in a decorated gourd.
That's a really nice detail.
That's the handkerchief. The mummified head of King Henry IV is important because this king is a direct ancestor of Louis XVI, so they are related.
These samples were actually tested for DNA evidence. What did they find when they did that?
Well, it's contradictory. When the bloodied handkerchief was first tested a few years ago, the geneticists who tested it said, yes, this is indeed the blood of Louis XVI. And he based that on a couple of things. First of all, the DNA that he looked at from this blood on the handkerchief came from a blue-eyed European male. And that matches with Louis XVI because he also supposedly had blue eyes. Now, that's not very strong evidence.
No.
So he dug a little further and he looked to the mummified head of Henry IV. And he looked at the Y chromosome of DNA extracted from this head. And he found what he said was a pretty good match between this Y chromosome and the Y chromosome of the blood taken from the handkerchief. And he put all this together and he said there's a pretty good chance that this handkerchief actually contains the blood of Louis XVI.
Not everyone was convinced by this evidence. What were some of their objections?
Well, there was so little of the Y chromosome taken from the head that the matchup between the head and the blood on the handkerchief could have just been due to chance. So what happened in this new study was a French historian teamed up with a geneticist from Belgium, and they looked at the relatives of French kings. These would be people that were somehow descended from Louis XVI's line, and they belonged to something called the House of Bourbon. And they looked at the Y chromosomes of a few of these individuals, and they created what they called the Bourbon Y chromosome profile. And what they found was this profile didn't match up with the blood on the handkerchief or the head of Henry IV. So they put all this together and they say that not only is the blood on the handkerchief probably not that of King Louis XVI, but even the mummified head may not actually belong to King Henry IV.
What about the original team? Did they take this new evidence and say, oh, you guys are right?
No, of course not. They are saying that looking at family trees related to royalty is fraught with problems. And they say that actually that the Y chromosome profile that these researchers constructed actually traces back to Philippe the first, who was apparently known to be gay and therefore should not have had direct descendants. So there's a lot of history, a lot of genetics going on here. Nobody's really agreeing. What's interesting is that a company has actually created a test where you can test to see if whether you're related to French royalty. But this is all based on the original findings of the genetic analysis of Louis XVI's supposed blood and King Henry IV's supposed head.
Next up, we have a story on cyborg cockroaches. If you've ever lived in an insect-infested dwelling, the idea of using your iPhone to control them might seem like a dream come true. How can I make this happen, Dave?
Well, Sarah, you can purchase Robo Roach number 12 for $99 from a company called Backyard Brains, and they will send you a live roach in the mail with a tiny little backpack, and all you've got to do is you've got to sand a patch of its shell on its head so that you can super glue some electrodes and insert a ground wire into the roach's thorax. Then you'll have to trim the antennae a little bit and insert silver electrodes into them. You'll have to fit the roach with a little backpack, and when you've done all of this, you can whip out your iPhone or other smartphone device and control the roach moving left or right, and possibly right out of your building.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's just one. Will it lead the others away? So why did they come up with this idea? What is it for?
Well, the company wanted to design a do-it-yourself neuroscience experiment, and these robo-roaches aren't really designed for the general public, although I'm sure you could order them. They're really designed for students as young as 10 years old, and the idea is to teach them ostensibly about how the brain works, how neuroscience works, and potentially even the interface between electronics and living organisms, also known as cyborgs.
So there actually are some objections to this, ethical questions that are raised by robo-cockroaches. Can you talk about that?
Well, some say that this is an animal welfare issue because you're basically taking a living organism, you're chopping off some of its body parts, you're gluing things into various parts of it, and then you're controlling it. So some people say that this is really an big ethical no-no. Some people have even written letters to the company saying that they are turning kids into psychopaths.
So what do the inventors say, or the purveyors of this say, in response to these kind of comments?
Well, they say we're not turning kids into psychopaths. Okay. We're teaching them about neuroscience, and this is very educational. If you don't like the product, you don't have to buy it. So a very interesting debate going on over RoboRoach number 12.
And I see from the comments on the article that it's continuing on the website.
It is, yes. So definitely check out the comments, and you can actually see a picture of RoboRoach 2 on the website.
Finally, we have another story on our chitinous friends. This is actually a fortuitous finding story. One lucky man found a tick in his nose and happened to be in the lab at the same time. How did this come about?
Well, he had what he says is a distressingly familiar itch in his nose. This isn't the first time he had a tick in his nose. And he did what any good scientist would do. He pulled out the tweezers, stuck them into his nostril, and yanked out a tick. And he's pretty sure where this tick came from. He had been in Uganda studying chimpanzees, and these chimpanzees are known to carry nostril ticks. And they jump from primate to primate. And as a primate himself, he wasn't super shocked that it had gotten into his nose. And indeed, this wasn't the first time it had happened. But at least this time, he was back in the U.S., back in his lab, and is able to analyze this little disgusting creature. And you can see a picture of this creature on the website.
So what did he find when he sequenced its DNA?
Well, what he found is that its sequence didn't match anything else known. He knew that the tick belonged to the genus Amblyomma, but beyond that, it didn't match any particular species, which could indicate that he found a completely new species of nostril tick.
But it could just be that we have a dearth of nostril tick DNA to look at.
That is also possible. That is also possible. And he says a lot more genetic analysis is going to be required. Perhaps some more researchers coming back to the U.S. with ticks in their noses.
Okay, so what's the weighty scientific import of this finding? Is it that they're likely to transmit disease?
Well, first of all, these ticks can transmit disease between primates, so that's always something important to study. The other thing is it's an interesting evolutionary story because if you're a tick, you don't want to be picked off by your host, and chimps are fastidious groomers. So you've got to hide somewhere that they're not likely to find. Now, there are a few orifices we could talk about, but for the purposes of this discussion, let's just say that the nose and particularly the nostril is the orifice they chose. Even though they are fastidious groomers, and they do indeed pick their noses, it doesn't seem to be enough to dislodge these ticks. So these ticks have evolved to find a very safe, comfortable and warm place in the body to hide out.
So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've been covering the Nobel Prizes this week, and you can see all of our coverage and analysis of these prizes on the site. We've also got an interesting story about the origin of the Jewish people. Turns out it may not be what most Jews, and indeed most historians, believe it to be in terms of where Jews actually came from in the world. For Science Insider, we've got a lot of coverage on the government shutdown that's happening in the U.S. and the impact it's having on science, everything from Arctic research to cell biology to even space science is being heavily impacted, and we've got analysis about all of that. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the wild west of open access publishing. It follows up on our sting operation, which we published last week about what exactly is going on with open access publishing. Next week's chat is about water resources. How is the world coping with a dwindling water supply? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site, Science Now. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and this policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
And that concludes the October 11th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.